Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. John was in Ecuador again, in the country that was just one of many battle lines, but that holds a special place in his heart. It was 2003, 35 years after he had first arrived as a member of a U.S. organization that bears the word peace in the name. This time, he had come in order to try to prevent a war that for three decades he had helped to provoke. It would seem that events in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Venezuela might be enough to deter the U.S. from another conflict. Yet, in Ecuador, the situation was very different. This war would not require the U.S. Army, for it would be fought by a few thousand indigenous warriors, equipped only with spears, machetes, and single-shot muzzle-loaded rifles. They would face off against a modern Ecuadorian army, a handful of U.S. Special Forces advisors, and jackal-trained mercenaries hired by the oil companies. This would be a war like the 1995 conflict between Ecuador and Peru that most people in the United States would never hear about, and recent events had escalated the probability of such a war. In December 2002, oil company representatives accused an indigenous community of taking a team of its workers hostage. They suggested that the warriors involved were members of a terrorist group with implications of possible ties to Al-Qaeda. It was an issue made especially complicated because the oil company had not received government permission to begin drilling. However, the company claimed its workers had the right to perform preliminary non-drilling investigations, a claim vehemently disputed by the indigenous groups a few days later when they shared their side of the story. The oil workers, tribal representatives insisted, had trespassed on lands where they were not allowed. The warriors had carried no weapons, nor had they threatened the oil workers with violence of any sort. In fact, they had escorted the workers to their village, where they offered them food and chicha, a local beer. While their visitors feasted, the warriors persuaded the workers' guides to paddle away. However, the tribe claimed the workers were never held against their will. They were free to go wherever they pleased. Driving down that road, John remembered what the Shuars had told him in 1990 when, after selling IPS, John returned to offer to help them save their forests. "The world is as you dream it," they had said, and then pointed out that those in the north had dreamed of huge industries, lots of cars, and gigantic skyscrapers. Now, the U.S. had discovered that its vision had in fact been a nightmare that would ultimately destroy us all. "Change that dream," the Shuars had advised John. Yet here it was, more than a decade later, and despite the work of many people and nonprofit organizations, including the ones John had worked with, the nightmare had reached new and horrifying proportions. When his outback finally pulled into the jungle town of Shell, John was hustled off to a meeting. The men and women who attended represented many tribes: Quechua, Shuar, Achuar, Shriwiar, and Zaparo. Some had walked for days through the jungle, others flown in on small planes funded by nonprofits. A few wore their traditional kilts, face paint, and feathered headbands, though most attempted to emulate the townspeople, wearing slacks, t-shirts, and shoes. Representatives from the community accused of taking hostages spoke first. They told the crowd that shortly after the workers returned to the oil company, over 100 Ecuadorian soldiers arrived in their small community. They reminded John that this was at the beginning of a special season in the rainforest, the fruiting of the chonta, a tree sacred to indigenous cultures. Its fruit comes but once a year and signals the start of the mating season for many of the region's birds, including rare and endangered species. As they flock to it, the birds are extremely vulnerable. The tribes enforced strict policies forbidding the hunting of these birds during chonta season. "The timing of the soldiers couldn't have been worse," a woman explained. John felt her pain and that of her companions as they told their tragic stories about how the soldiers ignored the prohibitions. They shot down the birds for sport and for food. In addition, they raided family gardens, banana groves, and manioc fields, often irreparably destroying the sparse topsoil. They used explosives in the rivers for fishing, and they ate family pets. They confiscated the local hunters' guns and blowguns, dug improper latrines, polluted the rivers with fuel oil and solvents, sexually molested women, and neglected to properly dispose of garbage, which attracted insects and vermin. "We had two choices," a man said. "We could fight, or we could swallow our pride and do our best to repair the damage. We decided it was not yet the time to fight." He described how they had attempted to compensate for the military's abuses by encouraging their own people to go without food. He called it a fast, but in fact it sounded closer to voluntary starvation. Old people and children became malnourished and grew sick. They spoke about threats and bribes. "My son," a woman said, "speaks English as well as Spanish and several indigenous dialects. He worked as a guide and translator for an ecotourist company. They paid him a decent salary. The oil company offered him 10 times as much. What could he do? He now writes letters denouncing his old company and all the others who came to help us, and in his letters calls the oil companies our friends." She shook her body like a dog shaking off water. "He is no longer one of us, my son." And I'll continue in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. An elderly man wearing the traditional toucan feather headdress of a shaman stood up. "You know about those three we elected to represent us against the oil companies who died in that plane crash? Well, I'm not going to stand here and tell you what so many say, that the oil companies caused the crash. but I can tell you that those three deaths dug a big hole in our organization. The oil companies lost no time filling that hole with their people. Another man produced a contract and read it. In exchange for $300,000, it ceded the vast territory over to a lumber company. It was signed by three tribal officials. "These aren't their real signatures," he said. "I ought to know. One is my brother." It's another type of assassination to discredit our leaders. It seemed ironic and strangely appropriate that this was taking place in a region of Ecuador where the oil companies had not yet been given permission to drill. They had drilled in many areas around this one, and the indigenous people had seen the results, had witnessed the destruction of their neighbors. As John sat there listening, he asked himself how the citizens of the U.S. would react if gatherings like this were featured on CNN or the evening news. The meetings were fascinating and the revelations deeply disturbing. But something else also happened outside the formal setting of those sessions. During breaks, at lunch, and in the evening, when John talked with people privately, he frequently was asked why the U.S. was threatening Iraq. The impending war was discussed on the front pages of Ecuadorian newspapers that made their way into this jungle town, and the coverage was very different from the coverage in the States. It included references to the Bush family's ownership of oil companies and to Vice President Cheney's role as former CEO of Halliburton. These newspapers were read to men and women who had never attended school. Everyone seemed to take an interest in this issue. Here John was, in the Amazon rainforest, among illiterate people many in North America consider backward, even savages, and yet probing questions were being asked that struck at the heart of the global empire. Driving out of Shell, back past the hydroelectric dam and high into the Andes, John kept thinking about the difference between what he had seen and heard during this visit to Ecuador and what John had become accustomed to in the United States. It seemed that Amazonian tribes had a great deal to teach U.S. citizens, that despite all the schooling and the many hours reading magazines and watching television news, U.S. citizens lacked an awareness these people had somehow found. This line of thinking made John think of the prophecy of the condor and eagle, which he has heard many times throughout Latin America, and of similar prophecies John has encountered around the world. Nearly every culture John knows of prophesizes that in the late 1990s, we all entered a remarkable period of transition. At monasteries in the Himalayas, ceremonial sites in Indonesia, and indigenous reservations in North America, from the depths of the Amazon to the peaks of the Andes, and into the ancient Mayan cities of Central America, John has heard that ours is a special moment in human history, and that each of us was born at this time because we have a mission to accomplish. The titles and words of the prophecies differ slightly. They tell variously of a new age, the third millennium, the age of Aquarius, the beginning of the fifth sun, or the end of old calendars, and the commencement of new ones. Despite the varying terminologies, however, they have a great deal in common, and the prophecy of the condor and eagle is typical. It states that back in the mists of history, human societies divided and took two different paths, that of the condor representing the heart, intuitive and mystical, and that of the eagle, representing the brain, rational and material. In the 1490s, the prophecy said, the two paths would converge and the eagle would drive the condor to the verge of extinction. Then 500 years later, in the 1990s, a new epoch would begin, one in which the condor and eagle will have the opportunity to reunite and fly together in the same sky, along the same path. If the condor and eagle accept this opportunity, they will create a most remarkable offspring, unlike any ever seen before. The prophecy of the condor and eagle can be taken at many levels. The standard interpretation is that it foretells that sharing of indigenous knowledge with the technologies of science, the balancing of yin and yang, and the bridging of northern and southern cultures. However, most powerful is the message it offers about consciousness. It says that we have entered a time when we can benefit from the many diverse ways of seeing ourselves and the world, and that we can use these as a springboard to higher levels of awareness. As human beings, we can truly wake up and evolve into a more conscious species. The Condor people of the Amazon make it seem so obvious that if we are to address questions about the nature of what it is to be human in this new millennium, and about our commitment to evaluating our intentions for the next several decades, then we need to open our eyes and see the consequences of our actions, the actions of the eagle, in places like Iraq and Ecuador. We must shake ourselves awake. We, who live in the most powerful nation history has ever known, must stop worrying so much about the outcome of soap operas, football games, quarterly balance sheets, and the daily Dow Jones averages, and must instead reevaluate who we are and where we want our children to end up. The alternative to stopping to ask ourselves the important questions is simply too dangerous. Shortly after John returned home from Ecuador in 2003, the United States invaded Iraq for the second time in a little over a decade. The EHMs had failed. The Jackals had failed. So young men and women were sent to kill and die among the desert sands. One important question the invasion raised, but one that John figured few Americans would be in a position to consider, was what this would mean for the Royal House of Saud. If the United States took over Iraq, which according to many estimates has more oil than Saudi Arabia, there would seem to be little need to continue honoring the pact the U.S. struck with the Saudi royal family in the 1970s, the deal that originated with the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair. The end of Saddam, like the end of Noriega in Panama, would change the formula. In the case of Panama, once the U.S. had reinstated its puppets, it controlled the canal, regardless of the terms of the treaty Torrijos and Carter had negotiated. Once the U.S. controlled Iraq, then could it break OPEC? Would the Saudi royal family become irrelevant in the arena of global oil politics? A few pundits were already questioning why Bush attacked Iraq rather than funneling all of its resources into pursuing Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Could it be that from the point of view of this administration, this oil family, establishing oil supplies as well as a justification for construction contracts was more important than fighting terrorists? And I'll continue in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. There also was another possible outcome. OPEC might attempt to reassert itself. If the United States took control of Iraq, the other petroleum-rich countries might have little to lose by raising oil prices or reducing supplies. This possibility tied in with another scenario, one with implications that would likely occur to few people outside the world of higher international finance, yet which could tip the scales of geopolitical balance and ultimately bring down the system the corporatocracy had worked so hard to construct. It could, in fact, turn out to be the single factor that would cause history's first truly global empire to self-destruct. In the final analysis, the global empire depends to a large extent on the fact that the dollar acts as the standard world currency and that the United States Mint has the right to print those dollars. Thus, the U.S. makes loans to countries like Ecuador with the full knowledge that they will never repay them. In fact, it does not want them to honor their debts, since the payment is what gives the U.S. leverage its pound of flesh. Under normal conditions, the U.S. would run the risk of eventually disseminating its own funds. After all, no creditor can afford too many defaulted loans. However, the U.S. does not have normal circumstances. The United States prints currency that is not backed by gold. Indeed, it is not backed by anything other than a general worldwide confidence in the U.S. economy and its ability to marshal the forces and resources of the empire the U.S. has created to support itself. The ability to print currency gives immense power. It means, among other things, that the U.S. can continue to make loans that will never be repaid, and that the U.S. itself can accumulate huge debts. By the beginning of 2003, the United States national debt exceeded a staggering $6 trillion and was projected to reach $7 trillion before the end of the year, roughly $24,000 for each U.S. citizen. Much of this debt is owed to Asian countries, particularly to Japan and China, who purchased U.S. Treasury securities, essentially IOUs, with funds accumulated through sales of consumer goods, including electronics, computers, automobiles, appliances, and clothing goods, to the United States and the worldwide market. As long as the world accepts the dollar as its standard currency, this excessive debt does not pose a serious obstacle to the corporatocracy. However, if another currency should come along to replace the dollar, and if some of the United States creditors, Japan or China, for example, should decide to call in their debts, the situation would change drastically. The United States would suddenly find itself in a most precarious situation. In fact, the existence of such a currency is no longer hypothetical. The euro entered the international financial scene on January 1, 2002, and is growing in prestige and power with every passing month. The euro offers an unusual opportunity for OPEC. If it chooses to retaliate for the Iraq invasion, or if for any other reason, it decides to flex its muscles against the United States. A decision by OPEC to substitute the euro for the dollar as its standard currency would shake the empire to its very foundations. If that were to happen, and if one or two major creditors were to demand that the United States repay its debts in euros, the impact would be enormous. John had these things on his mind on the morning of Good Friday, April 18, 2003, as he walked the short distance from his house to the converted garage that serves as his office, sat down at the desk, turned on the computer, and as usual, went to the New York Times website. The headline leaped out at him. It immediately transported him from his thoughts about the new realities of international finance, the national debt, and euros, back to that of his old profession. U.S. gives Bechtel a major contract in rebuilding Iraq. The article stated, quote, "The Bush administration awarded the Bechtel Group of San Francisco the first major contract today in a vast reconstruction plan for Iraq," end quote. Farther down the page, the authors inform the readers that the Iraqis will then work with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, institutions in which the United States enjoys wide influence, to reshape the country. Wide influence, there was an understatement, according to John. He linked to another Times article. Company has ties in Washington and to Iraq. John skipped through the first several paragraphs, which repeated much of the information from the previous article, and came to, quote, "Bechtel has long-standing ties to the national security establishment. One director is George P. Shultz, who was Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan. Before joining the Reagan administration, Mr. Shultz, who also serves as a senior counselor to Bechtel, was the company's president, working alongside Caspar Weinberger, who served as an executive at the San Francisco-based company before his appointment as defense secretary. This year, President Bush appointed Bechtel's chief executive, Riley Bechtel to serve as the president's export counsel. Close quote. Here in the articles was the story of modern history, the drive to global empire in a nutshell. What was going on in Iraq and described in the morning press was the result of the work Claudine had trained John to do some 35 years before, and of the work of other men and women who shared a lust for self-aggrandizement not unlike the one John had known. It marked the current point of the corporatocracy's progress along the road to bringing every person in the world under its influence. These articles were about the 2003 invasion of Iraq and about the contracts now being signed both to rebuild the country from the wreckage created by the U.S. military and to build anew in the mold of the modern, westernized model. Yet, without saying so, the news of April 18, 2003 also harked back to the early 1970s and the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair, SAMA as it was known, and the contracts flowing out of it had established new and irrevocable precedents that allowed, indeed mandated, U.S. engineering and construction companies and the petroleum industry to co-opt the development of a desert kingdom. In the same mighty blow, SAMA established new rules for the global management of petroleum, redefined geopolitics, and forged with the Saudi royal family an alliance that would ensure their hegemony as well as their commitment to playing by the U.S. rules. As John read those articles, he could not help but wonder how many other people knew, as he did, that Saddam would still be in charge if he had played the game as the Saudis had. He would have his missiles and chemical plants, the U.S. would have built them for Saddam, and the U.S. people would be in charge of upgrading and servicing them. It would be a very sweet deal, even as Saudi Arabia had been. Until now, the mainstream media had been careful not to publicize this story. But today, here it was. True, it was a mere inkling. The articles were only the meekest ghosts of a summary, yet the story seemed to be emerging. Wondering if the New York Times was taking a maverick stance, John visited the CNN website and read Bechtel Wins Iraq Contract. The CNN story was very similar to the one in the Times, except it added, quote, several other companies have at various times been reported as possible competitors for the job, either as primary bidders or as parts of teams, including Kellogg, Brown, and Root, the KBR, unit of Halliburton Company, of which Vice President Dick Cheney once was CEO. Already, Halliburton has won a contract, which could be worth $7 billion and could last up to 2 years to make emergency repairs to Iraq's oil infrastructure, end quote. The story of the march to global empire did indeed appear to be leaking out. Not the details, not the fact that it was a tragic story of debt, deception, enslavement, exploitation, and the most blatant grab in history for the hearts, minds, souls, and resources of people around the world. Nothing in these articles hinted that the story of Iraq in 2003 was the continuation of a shameful story, nor did they disclose that this story, as old as empire, has now taken on new and terrifying dimensions, both because of its magnitude during this time of globalization and because of the subtlety with which it is executed. Despite its shortfalls, however, the story did appear to be leaking out almost reluctantly, and we will continue the story of Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.